North Carolina politics were turned upside down today. A member of the State House of Representatives, a longtime Democrat, announced she is becoming a Republican. Her switch gives the GOP supermajorities in both chambers of the legislature, allowing the party to override vetoes of Democratic Governor Roy Cooper. And it unleashed a firestorm of criticism from Democrats who called for her to resign. WFAE's Steve Harrison has this report.
Tricia Cotham was one of the most well-known Democratic politicians in Mecklenburg, whose mother, Democrat Pat Cotham, is a longtime Mecklenburg commissioner. But on Wednesday morning, Tricia Cotham stood at the North Carolina Republican Party headquarters in Raleigh, wearing a dress that was unmistakably red. She hugged and laughed with the state's most powerful Republicans, House Speaker Tim Moore, Senate President Phil Berger, and Congressman Dan Bishop. She started by talking about who she is, a small business owner.
A woman with strong faith, a national championship basketball coach, and a public servant. Today, I add Republican to that list.
But why? Why would a longtime Democrat make such a bold switch? Cotham cast her former Democratic colleagues as close-minded bullies.
One of the absolute worst moments, which was a deal breaker, a turning point for me, was when I was criticized for using the American flag and the praying hands emoji on all my social media platforms, and even on the back of different vehicles that I have. I really could not believe that was the conversation that was happening at that time. And I was deeply offended.
Cotham served in the House from 2007 to 2017. She ran unsuccessfully for Congress, worked in the private sector, and then won a seat representing East Charlotte and Mint Hill in November. But when she returned, she said Democratic leadership treated her as a freshman. She voted with the GOP on some issues, like requiring sheriffs to work with federal immigration authorities.
I was considered a traitor, I was told, a spy. Please don't come to caucus. You'll tell everything we know. That is a terrible mentality, and that's just wrong.
She continued.
Women in the House caucus have said vicious and started vicious rumors that are very hypocritical of other stances that they make, attacking me on Twitter, in person to my face, attacking my mother, and saying something to my boys.
Frustrations with Cotham over her alliances with the GOP boiled over last month when she and two other Democrats missed an override vote on repealing the state's pistol permit law. That helped the GOP override Democratic Governor Roy Cooper's veto. The progressive group Carolina Forward blasted her on Twitter, saying she should be held accountable.
Perhaps they don't like what they can't control. It became very clear to me this was about control. On day one at the legislature, they picked the wrong chick for that.
Moore, the House Speaker, said he expects her to vote how she wants to. The biggest question is what her flip means for abortion rights. Abortion is legal in North Carolina until 20 weeks. Republicans want to restrict it further. Nearly a decade ago, Cotham spoke on the House floor about having an abortion for medical reasons. At Wednesday's news conference, she downplayed the singular importance of the issue. She also wouldn't say whether she would support restrictions at, say, 12 weeks or even 6 weeks.
I believe women are much more. We're business owners. We help create economies. We raise families. We carry it all. And so to always be tried just to that tragic, hard topic is wrong.
Well, Cotham's news conference was part celebration and an airing of grievances. Democrats reacted with fury. A few blocks away, at the state Democratic Party headquarters, Party Chair Anderson Clayton blasted the switch.
Representative Cotham's decision to switch parties is a deceit of the highest order. It is a betrayal to the people of Mecklenburg County. Reproductive freedoms are on the line. Our public schools are on the line. LGBTQ rights are on the line.
Yes.
Voting rights are on the line.
She stood in front of roughly 30 supporters holding black signs that said resign. Cameron Pruitt of the Mecklenburg LGBT Democrats spoke next.
And I got to say, it's a disgrace when Representative Cotham used our votes, our dollars, our door knocking, and then today stands next to Congressman Dan Bishop, who is no friend of the LGBTQ community, the author of HB2 that cost us lives and jobs and talent.
There were protests in Charlotte as well. Donna Marie Woodson, president of the Democratic Women of Mecklenburg County, said Cotham needs to meet with her group to explain herself.
She owes that to the Democratic Women of Mecklenburg County, who supported her. Yes. With their time and their treasure, we have supported her.
Cotham's district is heavily Democratic. President Biden won it by more than 20 percentage points. But if Cotham wants to stay in the House, the Republicans could draw her a new seat in Mint Hill and Matthews that gives her a better chance to win. For WFAE News, I'm Steve Harrison.
So I'm standing here on Piedmont Road Drive in South Park, right across from the Marriott Residence Inn, where an apartment complex or apartment building was under construction. At about 9:30 this morning, it caught on fire. There were, witnesses tell me, spectacularly high flames, 50 feet in the air. The fire has been put out now. The fire department is here still spraying water on it. But the entire area, I mean, it is just choked with smoke. There is ash all over the ground. Traffic has been stopped. I spoke with a man earlier, Walter Morris, whose nephew was in a construction crane above the site and who could not get down because the flames were so high. Apparently, the crane operator was able to finally climb down.
The heat got to him, you know, a couple of times. He was calling, said how hot it was, and eyes red, and, you know. He walked down. He climbed down and he walked to the stretcher.
Like you just heard, the crane operator is apparently okay, was taken to the hospital, and the fire has been put out. And we're just kind of waiting to hear whether anyone else was hurt and you know, what may have caused the fire.
What began as an ordinary day at an apartment building under construction in South Park this week became a scene of terror, after authorities say a truck used to install spray foam caught fire. The flames spread quickly, and within minutes, the construction site was ablaze, sending up a thick column of smoke visible for miles around the city. City officials last night confirmed two construction workers died in the fire. One was identified as DeMonte Sherrill, a father of four. The deaths are certain to prompt a workplace investigation. Kayla Young joins us now with more on what that might look like. She's a Report for America Corps member covering immigration for WFAE News and La Noticia. Kayla, welcome.
Hello, Nick. Thank you for having me.
Kayla, you reported on another case of construction worker deaths in January when three men fell to their deaths in the Dilworth neighborhood after some scaffolding collapsed. That was also at an apartment construction site. What's happened since that incident, and what can that tell us about how these investigations usually go?
One takeaway is that these aren't usually quick investigations into workplace fatalities. The most recent information that I've heard from the North Carolina Department of Labor is that the investigation into the January deaths in Dilworth is still ongoing and could take up to 6 months. The state's waiting until the investigation closes to make any public comments, so we still don't know that much. All of the workers who died were Latino immigrants in that case. Two men from Mexico and one from Honduras. What we do know is that the Charlotte Metrolinia Labor Council contacted the State Occupational Safety and Health Division in March with concerns that immigrant workers, particularly people without work authorization, have been fearful of cooperating in that investigation. This is what Labor Council President Ashley Hawkins told me then.
We have heard from workers that they were told not to share videos, that they were told not to participate, and we do not believe that OSHA has talked to all workers who were present at the time of the accident.
How has the Department of Labor responded to those concerns?
I'm waiting on a response from the department about their follow-up with the Labor Council. What's been requested is that the department provide workers deferred action, meaning that they would provide people who cooperate with the investigation a temporary protection from deportation. The idea is that workers would feel safer to come forward with that reassurance. This is something that's been established on the federal level. the Biden administration announced a process.
Pickleball is one of the fastest growing sports around Charlotte, but not everyone is happy. As WFAE's Nick Delacanal reports, a neighborhood park in East Charlotte has become the latest site of a pickleball controversy after the county replaced a basketball court with pickleball, leaving some neighbors with a sour taste.
It's a hot summer day in Sheffield Park near Central Avenue. The sun is beating down on a father and his two sons as they shoot hoops on a small half court near the street.
Just practicing on catch and shoot. Catch and shoot. That's all we're doing.
Chris Shelton's t-shirt is damp with sweat. He's been teaching basketball to his two sons, ages 10 and 11, for 4 years at this park. They live a few miles away. Until recently, they practiced on a more secluded full court that had trees and shade.
It's probably about 100 yards down.
But this month, workers began replacing that court with a pickleball court.
What was your first thought when you saw that?
It's like, wow. Wow. Those were good basketball goals down here. And why take them down to put up pickleball and there's not a lot of pickleball players?
He's not the only one taken off guard. Two sweaty teens dribbling on the half court next to him say they're also confused. They don't even know what pickleball is.
I never heard of pickleball.
It's like an easier version of tennis.
Oh, all right.
Down at the shaded court, workers are busy hammering stakes into the dirt where a fence will go up surrounding the new court. Gone are the basketball hoops, replaced by pickleball nets. There's a tennis court about 20 yards away, but that court wasn't picked for conversion. One worker, Jarrell Akaraz, says he knows not everyone is happy.
We have a lot of people that's, you know, not, you know, they're not okay with this, you know?
He says some people have flat out told them.
Like, what have people said?
That what we're doing is bull****, you know? Yeah, literally. Wow. Yeah.
Another neighbor, Matt Walsh, complained in an email to County Commissioner Mark Jarrell, highlighting the fast-changing community's racial diversity. A third of residents in surrounding neighborhoods are Black. Another third are white. He called the basketball-turned-pickleball court one of the craziest, most tone-deaf things he's seen. Mecklenburg County Park and Rec officials declined an interview, but said in a statement the Eastway Park-Sheffield Park Neighborhood Association requested the change. The association's president, Carolyn Millen, confirms this. She says for years, the secluded basketball court had been a hotspot for crime, witnessed by her and other neighbors.
If you have people up on the courts doing drugs and selling guns and other things over years, then that kind of, you're not going to have, you know, people going and using the park.
She says some neighbors were scared, and she kept hearing people were interested in pickleball. When she emailed the plans to more than 300 neighbors in June, she says feedback was positive.
I thought I had done something really pro and exciting for the neighbors and to get families back out.
Jarrell, the county commissioner who represents the area, says the incident raises questions for him. Did Park and Rec evaluate criminal data? Are they sure a pickleball court will reduce crime? And how many people got to weigh in?
Did the overwhelming majority of residents ask for pickleball courts? Or did we just do that?
Park and Rec has struggled to keep up with demand for courts as pickleball explodes in popularity, but Jarrell says the Parks Department shouldn't get so caught up that it adds pickleball courts where they're not wanted or displaces other people.
We want to make sure that we're not making decisions because of certain groups are there that, you know, play basketball or whatever the case may be, right? We've got to make sure that our areas are, you know, diverse places where communities can gather, whether it's for basketball, pickleball, tennis, or just to recreate in any kind of way.
In other words, pickles shouldn't be the only thing on the menu. For WFAE News, I'm Nick Delacanal.
It's Morning Edition on 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Marshall Terry. For those living with mental illness, the chances of being homeless are high. A federal survey in 2015 found 1 in 4 homeless people suffer from mental illness. Once homeless, they're more likely to end up behind bars. Going to jail can start a downward spiral. Many lose jobs or benefits, even health care. Some cycle between jail and the streets for years, often for minor crimes. Last week, WFAE, with support from the PBS series Frontline, examined the problem of inmates who wait in custody for months because they're too sick to stand trial. This week, we focus on inmates who serve what many in the court system call a life sentence on the installment plan. It's a symptom of our fractured legal and healthcare systems. And as WFAE's Dana Miller-Irvin reports, that's what's happening to Miguel Maldonado. We first met him last August. Like many stories in this series, this one is hard to hear. We grappled with how to tell it and how to do so with respect. WFAE feels it's important for you, the listener, to hear from Mr. Maldonado and others who are stuck in the fracture. We tried unsuccessfully to reach his family. When we first met Maldonado, he didn't have an attorney. He had waived his right to one. When he later requested an attorney, WFAE consulted with Gaston County Public Defender Stuart Higdon to ensure that we told this story accurately and with as much sensitivity as possible.
Miguel Maldonado says he lives on the streets of Gastonia, but I meet him in jail. He was picked up for indecent exposure on July 25th. I meet him a few weeks later. He's barefoot, wearing an oversized orange jail jumpsuit that's draped loosely over his shoulders. It's barely buttoned to his hips, so his chest is showing. He objects when a guard tells him to button up.
Button up a couple of those buttons.
I stopped moving, yeah.
Yeah, but you still got to button those buttons.
That hurt my bones.
Maldonado is convinced the jumpsuit is too small. He says it hurts his bones. But the jumpsuit is hanging off him. His booking sheet says he's only 5'8 and 145 pounds. Court records show Maldonado's been cycling in and out of jail here for almost two decades. He's 40 years old, and he's been charged with 92 separate offenses in the past 10 years. All are nonviolent crimes. 73 are for second-degree trespass, one of the lowest-level misdemeanors. You come here a lot, right?
Yeah, because I don't have my bones in the right place. But that's because when I come to jail for trespassing, they don't give me my size. This is too little. So I'm a big boy, and I just can't fix my body because I forget my mind with the Union City this little, yeah.
There is a phrase in the legal circle. You know, some people do life sentences, and some people do life sentences 30 days at a time.
Stuart Higdon heads the Gaston County Public Defender's Office. He wanted us to meet Maldonado. Maldonado is well known among the attorneys in Higdon's office. He's a regular client because of his mental health, Higdon says. Maldonado keeps getting arrested because he goes back to places where he's been arrested before for trespassing, like a local 7-Eleven where he stole two candy eggs, and a McDonald's where he was previously banned. It's not if he comes back to jail, but when, says the jail's administrator, Becky Cawthron.
Mr. Maldonado is very famous to all our detention officers. We all know him. There are a lot of people that become, I would say, almost like family, like they're at the house when they come here.
In October, a judge found that Maldonado didn't have the mental capacity to understand the charges against him or assist in his own defense. That meant he was incapable to stand trial. We don't know his exact diagnosis. That's privileged information. But the law says only those with a mental illness or, quote, mental defect, like an intellectual disability, can be found incapable. But Maldonado says he doesn't have mental health problems.
I'm okay. I just need to have the right clothes and the right shoes.
After he was found incapable to proceed, the district attorney dismissed his charges, and Maldonado went back to the streets. That happens a lot. North Carolina law says that those who are incapable to proceed have to be restored to competency so they can stand trial. But the wait times for a bed in a state psychiatric hospital are long. WFAE's investigation found that in Maldonado's part of the state, half of those charged with felonies wait more than 363 days for a state hospital bed so they can be restored. Most of Maldonado's charges are for misdemeanors, and the longest sentence for second-degree trespass is only 20 days. Since you can't be held longer than the maximum sentence, prosecutors frequently dismiss the charges.
It's a revolving door for a lot of these people with mental health issues. They're coming here returning, committing crimes that are small misdemeanors like criminal trespassing and begging.
Some, like Maldonado, end up back on the streets. Older court records show his last known home address is a shelter.
Mecklenburg homeowners saw the tax value of their homes surge in this year's revaluation of property. But many of the county's private golf clubs saw significant reductions in their tax value, even in affluent parts of Charlotte. WFAE's Steve Harrison has this report.
Quail Hollow Club is one of the city's most exclusive. It hosts the Wells Fargo Championship annually, and it will be the site of the PGA Championship in 2025. It's surrounded by multi-million dollar homes whose tax value increased this year. But the club itself, its taxable value tumbled from $13.5 million to a little under $10 million. Mecklenburg assessor Ken Joyner says the county worked with a consultant who specializes in golf courses to determine values. The county based the assessments on how much income Quail Hollow and other clubs generate, rather than how much their land and buildings would be worth on the market.
Well, I think you've got to look at the overall income viability of the operation there. You know, with Quail Hollow, it doesn't have a significant number of members. It doesn't have a large income stream.
Quail Hollow covers nearly 260 acres. South Park Mall could easily fit inside the course. Joyner says that land is theoretically valuable if it were redeveloped for homes or businesses. But he says Quail Hollow and other clubs have placed restrictions on the property, mandating it remain a course.
There's probably restrictions on what that course can be used for. It is really just kind of looking at the bottom line of what that golf course is worth in its current state.
Joyner says a number of country clubs nationwide just aren't as profitable as they used to be. Other exclusive clubs also saw their values fall. Charlotte Country Club in Plaza Midwood is down more than a third. Carmel Country Club in South Charlotte saw its value fall by 25%. Myers Park Country Club's value stayed the same at $16.5 million. For WFAE News, I'm Steve Harrison.
Charlotte hit a climate milestone with the start of spring Monday. For the first time since record keeping began, not even a trace of snow fell on the city this winter. WFAE climate reporter David Borax has more.
Weather Service records show there have been a few years where Charlotte got only snow flurries, most recently 2012 and 2005. But Charlotte didn't even see that this year. Last winter, Charlotte got 4.3 inches total, which is the city's average. As the planet warms with climate change, there's been a big change in the last 50 years or so. The average winter temperature in Charlotte is 4.1 degrees higher than it was in 1970. Jack Sheff is a climate scientist at UNC Charlotte.
As winters are getting warmer and warmer, it's just hard for it to be cold enough to snow during the time when precipitation is falling. That trend will continue as long as the planet keeps warming up.
Of course, it did snow in the North Carolina mountains, nearly 2 feet during one January snowstorm. But even there, this winter was drier in many spots. The Weather Service says Beech Mountain got just 12.5 inches of snow, compared with a normal of 70 inches. For WFAE News, I'm David Borax.
The past 2 weeks have seen some of the year's hottest weather in North Carolina, with temperatures in the high 90s and feels like heat index values in parts of the state over 110. Extreme heat is a risk for workers, but like most states, North Carolina has no standards or regulations to protect them. As the situation worsens with global warming, advocates say it's time for that to change. WFAE climate reporter David Borax has this report.
Abel Cruz and his co-workers are picking tobacco in Wilson County, about 40 miles east of Raleigh. It's in the low 90s, even hotter when they're working under the plants, says Cruz.
It's really difficult because sometimes the tobacco doesn't let the fresh air through. We'll be crouched down, cutting, and the air doesn't get to us. And the tobacco releases chemicals. With the smell and heat together, that's when we pass out.
We talked to Cruz after work at the labor camp where he lives with about 30 other workers. He's from a rugged area of central Mexico called Huasteca Potosina. He's 37 years old and has worked 17 summers in North Carolina, sending money home to his family.
We've cut sometimes to the point of going limp. Sometimes you don't feel your feet. They won't respond. Because when you're really dehydrated, that's when we lose our faculties.
He and thousands of other laborers, most from Mexico, spend summers on North Carolina's farms, often working 7-day, 70-hour weeks. The state ranks fifth nationally for the number of workers on seasonal H-2A work visas, with about 15,000, according to government data. Thousands more are undocumented. Many workers say they're acclimated to the heat. Santiago Hernandez drives a tractor at a watermelon farm in Wilson County.
I've worked in the field since I was a kid, and you get used to it from childhood. It's normal work for me.
Watermelon season coincides with peak summer heat. On the most scorching days, it's up to the boss whether you get a water break in the shade or even quit early, says Hernandez.
There have been days when the heat has affected work operations. We've stopped early when it's too hot, but if it's not too hot, we'll go until 6 p.m.
On the tobacco farm where Abel Cruz works, some days there is no break, he says.
Sometimes we don't get out of there. When you're out there, you feel like you're going to die. Nothing matters. In that moment, you want to go back to Mexico and never hear about it again. Because in that moment, when you're in full dehydration, you forget the end goal. You're out there and you can't give any more.
Extreme heat is the deadliest and fastest growing of all weather-related risks, according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. And the number of risky high heat days is increasing with climate change. The U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics estimates that an average of 43 outdoor workers die of heat exposure every year. Many thousands more wind up in emergency rooms with heat-related illnesses. Christy Ebi is a professor of public and occupational health at the University of Washington.
There's deep understanding of how heat affects our bodies. And there is deep understanding about what needs to be done to protect people during hot periods of time. And therefore, all heat-related deaths are potentially preventable.
But only 5 states have heat standards for outdoor workers: California, Oregon, Washington, Nevada, and Minnesota, according to the Natural Resources Defense Council. The federal government has heat safety recommendations, but no enforceable rules. The U.S. Labor Department is in the midst of a rulemaking, but it's not ready yet. North Carolina has no statewide standards, just some guidelines on Labor and Health Department webpages. The state's workplace safety law doesn't mention heat or temperature. State Labor Commissioner Josh Dobson was not available for an interview. A Labor Department spokeswoman told WFAE that if the federal government adopts a heat stress standard, quote, the NC Department of Labor will most likely adopt this heat stress standard verbatim. The bottom line for now, it's up to employers to do the right thing. And advocates say that's not enough at a time when global temperatures are breaking records.
But what we're seeing now is that the climate is getting hotter, heat waves are getting longer, stronger, and more frequent. And that puts workers at even greater risk than even just 10 or 20 years ago.
Juanita Constable is a climate and health advocate with the Natural Resources Defense Council, or NRDC. She's been working with labor and environmental groups.
A Charlotte Mecklenburg School Media Review panel considered 3 challenge books Tuesday and decided to remove one of them. Ironically, it's the only one that was popular with students. WFAE's Andos Helms reports.
A Court of Frost and Starlight is the third in a series of novels by Sarah Moss. CMS Library Services Director Kim Ray describes it.
It's a dystopian fantasy novel, wildly popular.
The first book in the series was fairly tame, she says, but
it gets a little more sexual as you move through.
A Court of Frost and Starlight was the only one in the Moss series that the CMS Media Advisory Panel reviewed, along with 2 books by different authors. All were challenged by local Moms for Liberty president Brooke Weiss, who has a daughter at Ardrickell High. A Court of Frost and Starlight was probably the least explicit of the 3, but it was the only one the group voted to remove by a slim margin, not just from Ardrickell, but from all schools.
This one definitely has some explicit sexual content, and the team wasn't convinced that that was related to moving the story along.
The 7 panelists were also split over Trix, a free verse account of 5 teenagers who fall into prostitution, and Jack of Hearts, a young adult novel narrated by a sexually active gay teen who dispenses detailed online advice to his classmates about sex in all its variations. Panelists said both had troubling content, but ultimately they decided the value for teenage readers merited keeping the books on the shelves. Ray noted that very few students are checking out either of those books. Ray, who's fielding the challenges, and Weiss, who's filing them, agreed afterward that CMS is moving toward a better system of helping parents understand what their students are reading and explaining their options for weighing in. Here's Weiss.
This is all I wanted. They didn't have it before. I think they are developing a much better process that involves parents.
But Weiss says she'll still ask the superintendent to reconsider the decision to keep Jack of Hearts. For WFAE News, I'm Ann Doss-Helms.
Charlotte still has its rural corners. Last week's 900-pound bull that escaped from a farm was a reminder of that. But what to make of the three Asian water buffaloes on the loose in northeast Charlotte earlier this summer? Well, that answer touches on a cultural misunderstanding, a changing city, and a set of surprised but supportive neighbors from various homelands. WFAE's Lisa Wharf reports.
James Road has seen its share of livestock as old farmland gives way to the creep of suburbia. But Asian water buffaloes wandering around was a singular event. Edgar McKinn saw them on the news.
New tonight, imagine seeing these buffaloes strolling right past your front door.
McKinn quickly figured out they belonged to his mom's neighbor.
When I saw it, like, wow, how come that he has those animals right here? Like, but it was cool.
Two were corralled within a couple hours, but a third made it 5 miles south through busy intersections to Albemarle Road Elementary School, where it was deemed a threat and euthanized by CMPD. The buffalo's home for a short time was a 7-acre plot they shared with lots of farm animals. McKinn's family, who are originally from Guatemala, likes having the animals close.
It makes me feel like, you know, back home, like we used to be have chicken, like goats and sheep everywhere, you know, so I like it. It's pretty nice.
The farm belongs to George Joseph, who comes from an agricultural family in South India and grew up with water buffaloes. He immigrated to Charlotte nearly 30 years ago. He said he didn't know the official name was Asian water buffalo.
We use that for milking. Poop is a good fertilizer. The male ones we're using for work in the field.
He says if he lost the water buffalo in India, it wouldn't be a new story. Joseph is a realtor and leads a team that flips houses. 5 years ago, when he bought the land where he and his wife live, he didn't expect to start a small farm, but he got his first lawn mowing bill for $800 and decided he could get the job done cheaper with some animal labor.
In the beginning, we started with three cows. Then we bought four or five goats. And later, after 2 years, I bought some sheep. Sheep eat more grass than goats.
That's all legal with a permit and permissible with neighbors who don't file complaints. You can have a cow in Charlotte. You just need 2 acres for it to roam and the proper shelter. Goats and sheep need a quarter of an acre each. Joseph no longer has the cows, but grew his herd of goats and sheep over the years. He also raises pigs, rabbits, ducks, and guinea fowl. On wires above them all sit a dozen or so vultures. He likes them because they keep things clean. Joseph sells many of the animals at livestock auctions, and he thought he might be able to do the same with water buffaloes, since he says there's a market among some Indians, Nepalese, and Bhutanese.
What made you decide to go from a sheep to a 2,000-pound buffalo?
I certainly like the buffalo meat. A lot of demand for that.
It's hard to find water buffalo meat in North Carolina. There's a farm in Salisbury, but Joseph says you can't always get big quantities. So he would go in with 20 other families and purchase water buffaloes from producers in Pennsylvania and South Carolina. The meat, not the living animal. But then...
I thought I can go buy a buffalo. That's why I went to get a buffalo from Alabama. I went all the way 480 miles from here.
He bought 3 of them in June. They were advertised on an exotic animal auction website. Joseph thought he would keep them for a few weeks, sell them, and make a few $1,000s. He only had the buffalo for 10 days or so, until he says some kids threw stones at them. Scared, they broke through the fence and made national news. Not all of his neighbors had heard about it, though.
Yeah, I don't know that
either.
Yeah.
Really?
Oh, my God.
So he had three water buffalo.
Oh, my God.
That's Nha Nguyen, who lives next door to Joseph. Growing up in Vietnam, she was used to seeing water buffaloes working in the rice paddies. She and her daughter, Lin Huang, are more interested than alarmed by their neighbor's latest livestock venture.
Yes. I think right here, it's no, they like it. That's it.
It's not always pleasant living next to all those animals, but like their Guatemalan neighbor, Huang says they do provide a reminder of home for her parents, and some solidarity too.
Like, they have a farm, we have chickens, like, they have a goat. It's definitely one of those things where it's like, okay, we can relate in that way.
And in some ways, she says that's emblematic of how things work among her neighbors, who come from many different countries. Low home prices attracted many immigrants to this corner of Northeast Charlotte.
It was kind of like a community thing where it kind of drew everybody together. Like, you don't know what you're doing. I don't know what I'm doing. You know, let's kind of help each other out kind of thing. Even though we don't speak the same language, but we'll try our best, right?
New neighborhoods have sprouted nearby over the past couple decades. Cesar Cruz lives in one right around the
Replace a dilapidated, crime-ridden public housing project with mixed-income housing. Add childcare, a senior center, and services for families. And make the centerpiece a school that can chart a path out of poverty for a new generation. That was the vision when Charlotte's civic leaders and neighborhood activists started to work on the Renaissance West Community Initiative. Sitting on about 40 acres just east of Charlotte Douglas Airport, Renaissance West represents one of the city's most ambitious efforts to break the cycle of poverty. It's located in what the city now calls the West Boulevard Corridor of Opportunity, an area that still struggles to claim a share of the region's prosperity. Over the next 3 days, WFAE's Ann Doss Helms looks at the progress Renaissance West has made and the hard work and patience it requires. Our series is called Renaissance West, A Slow Rebirth. She kicks off our series with a history of Renaissance West and a look at the school in the heart of the community.
In the 1990s, Charlotte started tearing down public housing complexes and replacing them with townhomes and apartments designed to bring together the poor and the prosperous. A few years into the 21st century, officials were looking at their next project.
Boulevard homes, severe distress is evident, and significant building deficiencies, deteriorated systems, major site and design deficiencies, inaccessibility, concentration of poverty, and isolation.
Ricky Hall, a longtime West Boulevard activist and former chair of the Charlotte Housing Authority, is reading from the authority's 2009 application for a federal grant. The authority wanted to demolish the 40-year-old complex with tiny apartments, mold, asbestos, and extensive physical decay. It was at the heart of a neighborhood where vacant buildings and substandard homes were common, crime was rampant, and kids were failing in school. Not that this was news to anyone. Hall, who's 66, says community residents had been pushing for better housing and opportunities since the late 1970s.
At one point, the West Boulevard corridor had the highest concentration of public housing in any one area, had the highest level of substandard and dilapidated housing, and a lot of the community leaders set out to change that.
Charlotte's leaders were starting to set their sights higher than just replacing buildings. In 2009, there was a community-wide book study about the Harlem Children's Zone, a cradle-to-career approach to disrupting generational poverty by pairing school reform with housing and support for families. When the Foundation for the Carolinas brought the Harlem Children's Zone founder, Jeffrey Canada, to Charlotte, he drew a sellout crowd of 1,500. So the application to replace Boulevard homes didn't just pitch new housing, but an education village with a high-quality child care center and a K-8 school. The Charlotte-Mecklenburg School Board promised to build that school. Charlotte got the federal Hope 6 grant, almost $21 million.
We all were kind of like the dog that caught the car, right?
Laura Yates Clark, who was director of the Council for Children at the time, was hired to coordinate all the public and private players who would have to work as a team to make the project happen.
It was a little bit of a Hail Mary. Nobody was really sure we would get it, and then we did.
Once demolition was approved, about 900 people living in the 300 units at Boulevard Homes had to be relocated. News accounts from that time indicate that many were eager to get away from violent crime. The crime rate for Boulevard Homes was more than 5 times the city average.
Yes, there was some crime here, a lot. Sometimes you hear a lot of gunshots. Over here, when I first moved over here, I kid you not.
Gabby Riley was president of the Boulevard Homes Residents Association. She had lived in several Charlotte housing projects, including some that were demolished and replaced with mixed-income housing. For tenants, that often just meant being displaced.
At first, I was against it because I feel like I've seen them time and time again promise certain things and don't deliver.
When demolition began, Riley moved into different subsidized housing. Meanwhile, progress on the new community inched along. It was 2013.